All right. Are you recording?
Yeah, no, I'm recording, but give me a second. I gotta go get a drink of water or something before we start.
Okay. Anime.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, what?
It's me, John Anime.
Hold on. What?
Today we're gonna be talking about.
Hold on. Where's Nate?
No, he's gone. He's in the other room.
What are you doing?
No, I got a few things to say. I've been listening to you guys for 2 years now, and you have the worst fucking opinions on the entire fucking internet. So I gotta get in here and show my mind here. All right, so just let me say my bit.
You're just gonna hijack the show?
Shut up. All right, hey everybody. Today it's Anime Death Spiral with John Anime. That's me. And today we're gonna be talking about Rurouni Kenshin.
Kenshin, huh? The pedo guy.
Unconvicted. He was unconvicted. The laws are different there. We have to respect their culture.
Go ahead.
All right. Today on Anime Death Spiral, we're talking about Rurouni Kenshin, the Kyoto Kerfuffle. And in this one, the fabled Rurouni Kenshin saga continues as the dastardly swordsman Rurouni continues those whimsical antics we all know and love. This time, in the famous state of Kyoto, Japan, known for its beautiful women and even more beautiful swordsmen.
What?
Rurouni deftly battles kami rebels while delighting children and the elderly with his deadly blade twirling. By this time, a masked evildoer from the past may finally spell out the end of the twirling pretty boy's decades-long adventure. Can the young Rurouni overcome his fear of the Western Super Bee?
What?
Or will the Red Menace finally turn the tables and install the first communist emperor of Japan? Fear not. This eye-popping entry into the medieval swords and sushi genre is sure to satisfy even the most bloodthirsty among us Japanime fans.
Are you done?
Okay, that's all I had to say.
I don't think some of that's right.
No, that is well-researched. You see,
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, I'm a Japanese culture anthropologist in my spare time on the internet.
Okay.
I know these things. I've read at least 4 Wikipedia pages.
You know, usually we don't write the show ahead of time. We kind of just, spit off the dome.
Yeah, and it shows.
Oh, wow. You hate the show so much, but you really strong-armed your way into it, huh? You're doing us a favor then, huh?
Yeah, I'm doing you guys a favor.
Great.
You don't know what you're missing out on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, can you please get up and go get Nate?
I'll see you next week, punk.
We're starting the show now.
Okay, all right, I'm back.
Okay, great.
I got distracted eating some macaroni salad. What's up?
Jeez, can you please don't relinquish your mic?
Oh, did my neighbor come in here?
I don't know who that was, but...
Yeah, he's a weird guy. You know, he's been leaving me weird letters on my doorstep saying stuff like, you suck, your opinions suck, anime sucks, and you suck for talking about it. That's pretty much it. He just leaves that same message over and over again.
That kind of sounds like your opinion.
Well, we're pretty good friends. We're pretty good friends at this point.
Yeah. It sounds like you guys get along pretty well. You have kind of the same opinion.
Well, yeah, I gave him a key to my house. You know, I trust the guy implicitly.
I was wondering how he got in there.
I am also wondering how he got in here, because even though I gave him a key, he is a 80-year-old diabetic security guard. He is wheelchair bound. Technically, he's chair bound. He's got one of those. They put a boot on his wheelchair, is what I'm saying.
Oh, they put a boot on his chair. I see. And you famously did. Take out all the accessibility features of your house.
But
right?
It was the first thing we did when we moved in, is we tried to make it as unwelcoming and inhospitable to as many people as possible. And that is obviously, where do you start with that? Obviously the differently abled. And can't have them just like coming and rolling around in here.
Uh-huh. You are one of those equal opportunity offender types.
Yes. We took out all the ramps, put in extra steps that have those little pigeon spikes on them.
Yeah. And you're racist against all types.
Hey, no, I love my fellow man completely and implicitly.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's just get into the show. You're going to put your foot in your mouth again here.
I feel set up.
Stolken. Welcome back to Animatsia Spelai Smielte.
Hey, cheeky breaky.
The only animation podcast that reaches all of the exclusion zone.
Hey, bliat, hey, stalker, hey.
Sika bliat.
Sika bliat.
The animation.
Why do you sound Italian?
I can't do accents. I've admitted this many times to the show.
As an Italian, I find that highly offensive, and I request that you stop immediately, unless you lean into it and get the big mustache thing going. Then we're okay.
I like Japonski animatsia.
Oh, you accuse me of putting my foot in my mouth.
Those are my people. You talk about being Italian. I've got the old Polish ancestry. I'm allowed to do that.
I mean, as we all know from historical records, Japan is more closely aligned with Italy than Russia.
I guess, you know, there was an era where that was true for sure. I guess, you know, the old Japanese Russo wars probably put a damper on the old cultural cross exchange, right?
I'm just saying that there is a healthy Italian cuisine subculture in Japan, and there's not a lot of Japanese vodka. That's all I'm saying.
Hold on. Don't they put ketchup on their spaghetti?
No. First of all, you're thinking of the dish known as pasta Napolitan, which obviously is referencing Napoleon, who is French, and therefore lesser on the European hierarchy.
Napolitan is not Napoleon.
Yeah, no, that's what it stands for.
This is a common mistake.
Napoleon 10. It's an abbreviation. Napoleon the 10th.
I'm pretty sure that's a Japanese thing, because I do learn everything I know about Japan through manga, as we've discussed. In fact, that is where I learned all about the Russo-Japanese War.
Yeah.
Golden Kamuy, that is basically a history textbook for me. I kind of learned almost everything about Japan's history through Golden Kamuy, which is award-winning, so I'm sure it's all accurate.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we don't tote the benefits enough on this show. Don't listen to history books. They lie. They're written by people with, you know, with ulterior motives. The only truth tellers in this industry are the manga artists, and they know exactly what's going on.
Yeah. The Meiji era.
Right? Oh, yeah.
The Reiwa era.
Showa, Heian.
Sure.
Yeah, all the eras, all the good ones.
The shogunates, the Tokugawa shogunate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Tokugawa, Noriega, all the classics.
Balenciaga. Yeah.
Gucci.
Miyamoto Musashi. That remember? He was a guy. He was a historical figure.
Yeah, he invented Miyamoto cars.
He wrote a really popular book, like the Bible, like the Japanese Bible, basically.
Yeah, no, that's right. He wrote the Japanese Bible.
Yeah, no, it is. It's called The Five Rings. It's all about how to be cool, be a cool guy.
I thought they had to get rid of the five rings. They had to toss them in the volcano at the end.
No, if you collect all the five rings, you get a wish.
I thought you turned into Super Sonic if you got all the five rings.
No, the wish Musashi will show up and he'll grant you one samurai wish.
Like Santa Claus? He's Japanese Santa Claus that lives on the moon?
Yeah, Santa Claus, the 100 man killer.
Oh, man. Okay. We are moving into that season, you know, and that means that...
The Santa Claus season?
We are moving into the Santa Claus season, as some people call it.
I guess that's true. I have been seeing more elf references all over the place.
Elf, so hot right now.
Yeah, that's the first sign of Christmas approaching.
I was going to say the first signs of the Christmas season for me is when you start seeing the deluge of low-budget Santa Claus-themed horror movies that come out on all the streaming services. Stuff like Santa's Sleigh, Silent Night, which is different than Silent Night, Deadly Night. Great series, no notes, love that one. Love me a Clint Howard movie.
I think it's a reference. I think it's supposed to be referential. Mm-hmm.
Well, there was the David Harbour one that came out last year, year before that, Violent Night.
Oh, yeah.
Where he plays a violent Santa Claus.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Skip that one. didn't need that in my life.
You already gave him money out of your own pocket for Hellboy. Why would you give him one for the Santa Claus movie?
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, we got that Jack Black one that's coming out where he plays Satan Claus.
Satan Claus, yeah. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ. Makes one yearn for the Tim Allen days, doesn't it?
I don't know. I think we're about to move into an era of Tim Allen resurgence. We'll see.
You know what? Silent Night, Deadly Night, like you mentioned, I happen to actually like a lot of those. There's about six of them, I think.
There's five, and I've seen all of them. Yeah. And for a low-budget Christmas horror series that's been going on since the early 90s, it was surprisingly diverse. Each movie has its own unique character and directorial voice.
Well, not the second one.
Well, only about 40% of it. Once Ricky gets out of the insane asylum and they start doing that's when they start doing all of the new footage, which I don't know if you so we got a DVD set with Silent Night, Deadly Night 1 and 2 on it, and we were watching the special features.
Of course.
And
naturally.
One thing interesting I found out about the production of the second one is, so are you familiar with the history of the release and how, like, Ebert and Roper were saying, like, oh, this is the, you know, this is degrading the spirit of Christmas. This is awful. Based off of the one poster of, like, the Santa Claus arm, and it's holding the axe while he goes down the chimney. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But explain it to the people.
Okay. When the Silent Night, Deadly Night, the first one, came out, they released the poster, and it's just an image of Santa climbing down the chimney, and he's carrying an axe. And everyone kind of had a big fit about it, saying that, like, oh, this is offensive to Christians, blah, blah, blah.
Good.
You know, this is ruining Christmas for the kids. Also good. Yeah. And a bunch of TV movie critics, like Ebert and Roper, got in on it and saying, like, oh, this is the worst movie ever. This is just violent dribble. And so...
Dribble?
Dribble.
Gotcha.
Anyway, and so the studio released the film and then decided that they would release a re-edited cut the following year, where they would shoot additional footage to fill in story gaps or whatever, reshoot some stuff, and then re-release it. And they ended up shooting too much footage. And they said, well, why don't we just, like, we'll take clips from the first movie that we were going to edit these into and just have them be flashbacks, and we'll just use all of this new footage to fill out the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even originally supposed to be a sequel. It was supposed to be, like, re-edits to a movie that already came out in theaters, which, you know, as I think Bob Ross would call it, it turned out being a happy little accident. Because we got Garbage Day out of it.
Yeah, I mean, Garbage Day is good. It's sort of a waste of time, to be honest, especially when the other movies are so much better.
Yeah, it is a highlight of an overall boring movie. I still like the first one just because the image of, like, a big blonde lumbering hunk going around killing people while he says naughty is...
it's pretty good. When he punches that guy. Oh, man. One of the best punches.
But once we get to the third one with Bill Moseley, and he's playing a lobotomized Ricky who has, like, a glass dome head that shows yes. his brain.
It's so good. That's so much fun. There's a lot of good ones. I don't want to shit on all of them. You know, what my favorite one, I talk about this every year, but my favorite one is... of course, Deadly Games. Do you remember Deadly Games?
Yes. I love the French Canadian. No, just French.
It's French, but it's also called Code Père Noël in France.
Yes. I also, people describe that as violent Home Alone, right?
Yes. It's like violent, evil Home Alone, and it fucking rules. I really, really like that movie. And the kid is great in that movie because, unlike Macaulay Culkin, the kid is, like, full-on ready to murder. The first thing he does is, like, I am going to kill this guy.
Yeah.
and he does.
Well, what's even better is that the first half of the movie, the kid is gearing up. He thinks that Santa, like the actual Santa Claus, is coming to fucking kill him in his house.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I am gearing up. I'm going to fight Santa. And then it turns out that it's not Santa. It's a homicidal maniac. And he's like, all right, switching gears, going to kill this guy too.
Yes. And guess what? The anime connection. He does it with a fucking samurai sword.
It's so cool.
He has a samurai sword. He's so cool.
The first time I saw that movie, it blew my mind because the very beginning, when the kid is in the subway and he just goes up to a public like computer terminal. And I don't know if that was a real thing in late 80s France.
Who knows?
But the fact that there was like a public computer fax terminal that anyone could walk up and use and look up stuff on the internet was mind blowing. That's a great movie.
It's a great movie. You know, the other one I think about a lot, it's not as dear to my heart as those two, but did you ever watch Rare Exports?
That keeps popping up on my suggestions for Christmas horror movies. That came out in like 2010, I think.
Yeah.
2011.
It was a little while ago.
And that is Canadian. That one's Canadian.
No, that one's not Canadian. That one's Scandinavian.
Oh, is it? I thought it was.
Yeah, it's like from Norway or Finland or one of those places.
Quebecois getting no wins in this one.
Yeah, no, they're out for the count here. The fact that they speak that weird Scandinavian, whatever the fuck that language is, really, it like ups the weirdness
Norwegian
of the whole thing. Norwegian, yeah. And that's the one where like the Finnish loggers like accidentally unearth a sort of The Thing style like Santa alien. And they bring it back to their barn, and it de-thaws in the barn and becomes like a horrible Santa goblin.
That's awesome. I didn't know that's what it was about.
It's so cool. It's so cool. It is really The Thing if The Thing was Santa Claus.
Okay, you've sold me.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to be watching
so
that one
cool.
next.
Anyway, you should watch that movie. It's really good.
All right, I will. Can I tell you about what I've been doing to get into the Christmas spirit, specifically related to anime?
You've been watching Christmas anime.
I am always on the hunt this time of year for Christmas anime. You guessed it.
Yeah, yeah. We've got, we've got the Satoshi Kon one,
mm-hmm,
Tokyo
mm-hmm.
Godfathers.
Tokyo Godfathers. There's obviously the classic, cinematic classic, the Love Hina Christmas special.
Sure, sure.
Gotta watch that one every year.
Kaguya-sama had a Christmas episode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kaguya-sama. The Golden Boy Meets Santa Claus episode where he goes to the North Pole and tries to get with all the sexy elves. And elves are sexy, by the way. They're not little people. You know, they are like Santa's elves are like Lord of the Rings elves. They're tall and blonde and sexy.
Yes, when you think Santa and elves together, you do think of like weird little dudes. But they went sexy elf for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so this year, my search for Christmas anime landed me on one of the most bizarre premises that I've come across in idol anime. And this is an idol anime, unfortunately.
Okay, and this does have a Santa in it?
It doesn't have a Santa yet, but it is leading up to what I can only assume is a big Santa.
Okay.
And so let me get into it. Yeah, let me give some context here. I started watching the first few episodes of an anime called 22/7, or 22/7, however you want to pronounce that.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the title of the anime. It's 22 and then, you know, a backslash and then the number 7.
I don't understand.
I don't understand it either. I assume they're leading up to an explanation. And so that is both the name of the anime and the title of the, central idol girl group that it is about.
Oh, so it's like the Akiba 48 or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Something
okay,
along
yes.
those lines.
Okay. I get it. I get it.
Yeah. And so we start off with our main character, our female lead, a girl named Miyu Takahata. And she is surprisingly, something you don't see quite as often as the male counterpart, but she is a Chunibyo. She's a weird little loner who, you know, always has hair covering her bangs.
Yeah.
So no one can see her eyes.
Does she have an eye patch?
She doesn't have an eye patch, no.
Oh,
she could get an eye patch, and that would make her a lot cooler, I will say.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It's cool to lose an eye, kids.
It's so cool.
Ava did it.
It's so cool if actually you could see fine, but you just wear one anyway. That's actually cool.
Yeah.
Then you could say you're doing it like a pirate.
Well, I don't know. There's some basis in that. Like, it's kind of a common fashion thing to just wear a face mask even when you're not sick.
Face masks are a little different from an eye patch.
It's like an eye patch for your face, for your mouth and nose.
Sure, yeah. I'm keeping my eye from being infected. Yeah, only the one.
Oh, no, I'm only wearing a mesh eye patch, so I can still see out of it. Anyway, we start off and, you know, as expected, her life sucks. She's a 16-year-old high school student, no father. Her mother is chronically ill, and so she has to take care of both her mother and her younger sister.
Stock female backstory number two.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah,
really branching out from the main path here.
Yeah.
So all of that, all of those classic, you know, poor her, I'm going to call them poor her traits.
Female portrait.
Female portraits. And so one day, after getting in an argument with one of her coworkers who was complaining about how she doesn't smile enough to the customers, you know, she goes home and finds a mysterious black letter in her apartment's mailbox. And like many rags to riches stories go, an anonymous person tells her to go to an undisclosed location without telling any of her family to give her an important message.
Is this a death game?
I wish. It has so much. Well, we will get to it. We will get to it, I promise. Okay.
So, I'm sorry. Continue, please.
So she gets this letter. It says, "Congratulations. You've been chosen to be part of the new Idol Project 22-7. Go to the zoo in front of the gorilla enclosure tomorrow at this time and don't tell anybody."
Never go to a second location.
Never go to a second location. And so obviously she's like, well, I don't know what this is. I don't want to do this, but... You know, I got nothing else going on and my life sucks. So I'll check it out. I'm just going to go check it out. And if it seems sketchy, I'll leave. First mistake.
First mistake is that's already sketchy.
Yeah, that's already. How do they know?
It's already sketchy.
So she goes there the following day and is surprised to discover that there's not one or two or three, but seven other girls that have received similar letters that were all told to meet in front of the gorilla exhibit at the zoo at this time on this day.
Sure.
And as you can imagine, there's, you know, eight girls total. That's one of each girl, right? That's all the types.
Yeah, and the title has a seven in it. So one of them is definitely going to die.
And so they're all standing around trying to figure out, you know, like what's going on, who called us here, when... A terrifyingly large man in a dark suit and sunglasses comes up to them and says, "Hey, everybody, you need to come with me into this dark alley."
Dope.
"And I've got a special surprise to show all of you."
Hey, great.
And they're like, "Yeah, this is awesome. Free lunch or whatever, right?" "We're going to see some puppies and get some candy."
Cool. He's going to pass out pizza juice boxes.
And so he leads them to a secret elevator that takes them into a giant underground idol training facility built underneath the zoo.
Wow.
That is correct. The zoo is a front for a government-run idol training facility.
No, that makes sense. That's mm-hmm. I mean, that makes sense. You know, every major facility in Japan is a front for either an idol facility, an underground fighting ring,
giant robot storage.
Yeah, giant robot storage, chemical weapons factory.
That's where they keep the demons that they have locked up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The occult training grounds.
Yep. So anyway, he's like, all right, congratulations, everybody. You've been chosen to be the new hit idol group. You're all going to start training and dance and singing immediately. And the first thing you must wonder is like, all right, so obviously all of these girls have some kind of like, you know, performance or media background or something that would make them likely candidates for being in an idol group, right? In a pop group.
Well, they got to at least be attractive, right?
Well,
like stunningly attractive.
I mean, I guess that must be the only qualification because several of them say like, yeah, I cannot sing and I cannot dance and I can prove it. And they're like, yeah, that doesn't matter. You were chosen for a reason. So like you're the team, you're the ones. And so they're like, but okay, who chose us? Like, what's going on here? Like, who's sending out these letters? And he's like, all right, come with me. I'm going to show you the final room on the tour. And he leads them into a giant room, a giant ornate, room with marble pillars and red carpet.
Uh-huh.
And inside of it is a giant Kubrickian monolith carved with intricate astrological and religious like imagery.
Dope.
And the guy says, all right, this is the wall. We take all of our orders from the wall.
Estokel, the monolith.
Yeah. It's the wish granter.
Monolith.
He's like, we take all of our orders from the wall, and it is decided that you eight are going to be the next hit idol group.
From today onward, you are Monolithians.
And specifically, it says, we're going to train you, and you're going to make your debut on Christmas Eve this year, and you're going to be, like, the biggest pop sensation that's ever lived.
Bigger than Michael Jackson?
Eight. Times bigger.
Damn, that's crazy. I guess if they do have an all-knowing monolith on their side, maybe they have a chance.
And so they're like, what? That's stupid. Specifically, our lead girl is like, I am not cut out for this. This is not what I signed up for at all. And does the smartest thing she will ever do in this series and immediately walks out and is like, fuck that. This is sketchy. This is weird. I do not want to be an idol. I don't want to be in front of like a stage. I don't like people judging me.
I don't want to be mind controlled by the monolith.
Yeah, I don't want to be mind controlled by the fucking monolith. And so she goes home to her poor ass family.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, hey, did anything weird happen today? And she's like, no, everything's fine. Shut up. And so... okay, first of all, I should mention that the monolith, like, does its way of communicating is it spits out a little engraved business card. Like, it has a slot on the front of it.
It has a slot. Great.
It has a slot on the front of it, and
very
it shoots
good.
Out little business cards with messages written on them.
Okay, all right.
And when she's leaving, it spits out a card that says, basically, you'll be back. Like, you don't have a choice in this.
A sucker. I've seen the future.
And so the next day she goes into her job and her boss fucking fires her for being an unfriendly bitch.
Jesus.
His words, not mine.
Oh my God.
And then she goes home and discovers that like her family is even poorer than she thought. And like, she's like, I don't know how we're going to afford food. Another key detail about her character is that she's good at playing piano. She likes writing piano songs.
Piano songs. Yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
You know, songs on the old piano. And so she very sadly decides to hawk her keyboard for some cash to buy groceries for the week. And then, she's like, all right, well, shit, I guess I have no money. And I'm a 16-year-old high school girl. I can't drop out of school to work full time because that's illegal because of child labor laws or something. And she's like, I guess I'll be a fucking idol. And I'm going to go in there and I'm going to do something that I hate to earn money for my family. Her words, not mine.
Very relatable.
Yeah. And so she then, you know, is resolute to go back to the monolith. And say, all right, all right, you, I'll be in your girl group, but I'm not going to like it. And he's like, yes, you are. You're going to like it.
You're going to love this.
And then from there on out, it's more bog standard idol anime tropes, like the inciting conflict of the second episode is everyone's kind of vying over the coveted central slot, right?
Sure. Yeah, team leader.
Who gets to be center girl? And as you would expect, there is the hotshot go-getter who thinks she's better than all the other members, and she's gonna be center because she's the best one. She wants it the most.
Right. She's the Harry Styles.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, boy, is she Harry Styles.
Yeah.
And she's Harry Styles to our main characters, Joe Jonas.
Gotcha.
And so they come into conflict when the monolith announces that shy little Miu is going to be center girl. And his word is absolute.
Isn't that a dynamic that kind of comes out naturally over time?
I suppose it would be something more like in a traditional narrative without the monolith. Which is hard to imagine, I know, because the monolith is so central to everything that makes this anime remotely interesting.
It does seem like the second lead of the show. But, like, nobody thought Posh Spice was, like, the central Spice until, like, a little bit into the Spice Girl's career. Then it became pretty apparent.
My favorite one was Monolith Spice. You know, the giant black pillar Spice that's always on the back of the stage.
Yeah, yeah. Really great appearance in the movie.
And so the monolith, you know, decrees that Miu is going to be center girl, and this makes our hotshot go-getter Harry Styles girl all ruffled up, and she does some bog-standard anime bullying type stuff until they have a confrontation moment at the end of the episode where she says, hey, stop being a hotshot Harry Styles guy. The monolith said I was going to be center girl, and so I'm going to be center girl, and even though I don't want to do it, I'm going to work my hardest at it. And that seems to mollify Harry Styles girl a little bit. And she's like, all right, well, as long as you're working the hardest you can, I guess I'll let you be center girl for now. But if you ever slip up, I'm coming for you. So
sure.
If I had to guess, if they are going to be dropping a member to bring it down to an even seven, then it's probably going to be Harry Styles going rogue and either going solo or maybe joining an evil idol girl band.
Right.
Maybe possibly one managed by an evil monolith.
A rival monolith.
Now, if there was a hotshot Harry Styles monolith counterpart to the central monolith, that would be something.
They could develop sort of moving away from the One Direction. They could develop sort of like a NSYNC and Backstreet Boys rivalry. Like our main character, our anime girl Justin Timberlake, and whoever the Backstreet Boys guy is, they got crushed. I don't really remember those guys' names. Who is it? Backstreet Boys?
Nick Cannon. Remember?
Not Nick Cannon. No, Nick Carter.
Nick Carter.
Nick Cannon.
Nick Carter's hilarious, Daddy.
Yeah, a Justin Timberlake versus a Nick Carter.
Yes. But again, as giant unspeaking monoliths that just kind of shoot like psychic pop music energy at each other.
Yeah, the monolith in this case would be Lance Bass.
The best thing this show could do would be to drop all eight girls and just have it be about the monolith. I have so many questions about the monolith, and they put up signs all over this facility saying, please do not ask questions about the monolith. But it's always in the front of your mind.
It does seem like it would end up being sort of a Hypnotoad scenario. You have the girls dancing in front, and then everyone's just sort of hypnotized by the monolithian power.
The monolith that only communicates via little business cards.
Yeah. Monolith.
So that is 22-7 so far. We are leading up to the big Christmas debut, which I can again only assume it features a evil Santa Claus monolith. That's where I think they're going with this.
That would be great if Santa Claus was a monolith and Santa Claus monolith descended to interrupt their Christmas show. Man. That'd be great. I'd be way into that. If that happens, let me know, because I'll start watching that show.
Yeah. All right. I'll let you know. But
yeah.
Right now, the word monolith is starting to lose meaning for me. Why don't you tell me about something you watched?
Monolith. Well, before we leave the Christmas thing, I did want to mention there are a couple Christmas anime. Not that many. I mean, Christmas is so weird in Japan, right? Because it's not really like Christmas everywhere else. Because obviously, Japan did slaughter their Christian population
for good reason.
I'm not no judgment either way. It's a thing that happened. We're just gonna move on.
We're just gonna move right on.
So they do have sort of a unique Christmas celebration where
the impression that I always got from anime and manga is Christmas Eve. I think specifically Christmas Eve is seen more counterpart to the Western concept of Valentine's Day, where it is a romantic holiday for couples to either, you know, confess their love to each other or to celebrate an existing relationship.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a super important date night that you can't blow or you probably will break up.
Yeah,
at least that's my understanding from anime.
It has led to a counter subculture of people who, you know, gather as singles at bars specifically to hate on couples getting lovey at Christmas.
Well, that is not a Japanese specific thing. That is everywhere.
That's my Friday night every week.
Yeah, sad people do generally gather at bars on Christmas Eve and attempt to drown either their sorrows or themselves.
I think you could end the sentence at sad people tend to gather at bars.
Yeah. The other weird thing, of course, is the KFC thing, the fried chicken thing. That is unique to Japan. That is a very weird
thing. And that
ties
into their baseball mythos as well, so it gets even more complicated beyond the Christmas angle.
And there's Santa, right? Because, you know, to a Japanese person, I guess the colonel does have sort of a Santa vibe.
Yeah, you know, he's got a white beard, a white suit with the little black bolo tie.
I mean, to us, he obviously represents, like, you know, a plantation owner from the
1800s. You know, Santa's workshop with the elves is a type of plantation, if you think about
it. Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, the connection is there. I don't blame them. But that is a weird thing. Generally over here, we would consider it the Christmas goose.
Mm-hmm.
We are more of a Scrooge, Wonderful Life type Christmas culture over here. Not much room for KFC.
Yeah, give me my Jimmy Stewart's, you know, give me my Albert Finney's.
Yeah, your Muppet's Christmas Carol, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, Christmas popping up in popular culture tends to have like a bit of a different connotation to it. It's usually either downplayed or maybe I don't know, misconstrued perhaps. But there are a couple great representations in anime. Of course, one of them being legitimately good, which I think is Gundam 0080 War in the Pocket. This is the sequel to Gundam 79.
This is the Gundam Christmas special.
It is the Gundam Christmas special, which is essentially a riff on the World War One Christmas truce.
It's where the ghosts of wars past, you know, come at night to teach Char about all the evils of being greedy and genocidal.
No, Char is pretty self-righteous. He would not be turned away by the rattling chains of ghosts past. But people fighting on the ground, you know, the people who are just grunts, they're kind of more invested in the whole not killing each other thing.
Char would be like, fuck off, Marley, that's slave mentality. I'm a new type.
Dog, I am bringing new types to Earth. Ghosts have no room here. War of the Pocket's really cool, though. It's like, a lot of criticism of Gundam 79 is that Amuro Ray is sort of the destiny child, speaking of boy bands or idol groups.
Mm-hmm.
And his view of the war is very distant and lofty. And so we don't get that many angles on like what it means to be like a dude who's just not in a Gundam. You know what I mean? He's just like the dude who's like, oh, I got to pilot the Zaku again. or even worse, one of those fucking like floating tanks that get blown up immediately.
Oh, yeah.
And War in the Pocket is more about like those guys. So it's an interesting supplemental material to the original Gundam series, and the Christmas angle is kind of cool. As far as like Santas go, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but one of the manga I picked up earlier was a Santa manga.
A manga about Santa or one that just features him?
This is a manga. Well, you tell me. I'll tell you. I have not started it yet, but I did want to mention it since Christmas is coming up. This one is called Sanda. I think it's called Sanda with a D.
Okay, because Sando is their abbreviated loan word for sandwich. Tamago Sando.
We say that too. I say that all the time.
Sando's for brekkie, lunch, and dinner, baby.
I don't like brekkie, though. That's bad. Sando Sando is about a future where, I guess, it's sort of like a Gattaca scenario where everybody's really into like creating the perfect human, and it's like there's lots of gene editing and plastic surgery.
But in this case, the perfect human is Santa Claus. Santa Claus represents the genetic peak of human potential.
No, Santa represents the beautiful flaws of humanity, because a child named Sanda Kazushige is a middle school student who is just hitting puberty and becoming very self-conscious of the fact that he is not like sexy and like, you know, ripped and all this shit. He's like very self-conscious about his body.
Mm-hmm.
And then for a series of strange events happen, and he develops the ability to morph into a super Santa Claus to battle against the world's evils.
Huh? Does he have a giant sleigh mech that he gets in?
Again, I don't know. I haven't started reading it yet. I'm very excited to take it on. All I know is he morphs into a big ass fucking Santa who doesn't have a big long beard. He actually just kind of has like very manicured white beard. He's not really wearing the full suit. He's kind of got
like
a
clean
Santa.
Cut Santa.
Yeah, he's got a Santa vibe going on.
He's Matrix Santa.
He is very much called Santa Claus, so there is no mistaking it. He is a Santa. So we've got a full ass Santa Claus manga. I wanted to shout that one out before we moved on, because Santa Claus usually appears just as a joke. You know, there's not a lot of like Santa Clauses running around.
No, it's
usually it's like the joke character shows up and he's wearing one of those little caps.
Yeah.
What do you call those? Stocking caps?
Yeah, stocking cap. I just call it a Santa hat, right?
Santa hat.
Yeah.
King hat.
Yeah, he's more of a visual gag. I think, you know, like you said, he's more tied into marketing and like commercial campaigns.
Yeah.
I think more often you see a much more Christian-centered angle when they talk about Christmas in anime. Angels come up a lot, you know. A Christmas angel is the central character, or one of the central characters in the Love Hina Christmas special.
Oh, God, Jesus Christ.
There's the belief that the Christmas angel will grant your wish if you confess your love on Christmas Eve.
Sure. In Gundam Wing Endless Waltz, which of course takes place on Christmas.
It's a Christmas movie. I was going to bring that up when you brought up the other Gundam one. Yeah.
Wing Gundam, of course, dresses up as Santa Claus. It delivers the presents of nuclear annihilation.
He has a giant metal sack where he drops nukes on all the the boys and girls.
The other representation, of course, being essentially skimpy Santa suits for all the female characters to wear in the Christmas
episode.
Yeah,
but we do that too. You know, that's all on Japan.
That's not on Japan. That does happen everywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, Christmas sucks. Who cares? We did other anime stuff, like regular-ass anime stuff.
Regular-ass anime stuff.
Yeah, let's talk about some other regular-ass anime stuff.
All right. Well, I talked about my thing, which counts as both regular-ass anime and Christmas anime. So what do you got?
This is a little weird. I'm not sure why I did this. Maybe this comes in the same spirit as like why I read Soul Eater, or I don't know, D. Gray Man, perhaps.
Oh, it's because of your crippling depression that makes you choose badly.
I think it's a morbid curiosity at the end of the day, but I went ahead and I just accidentally read all of Blood Lad. Are you familiar with Blood Lad?
It sounds like a great name. Like, I'm intrigued, but the way you're talking about it says otherwise. But just right off the bat, Blood Lad is a great title.
Bloodlad. Bloodlad is a good title. I don't want to cast any aspersions on Bloodlad as a title. It's great, obviously. Bloodlad is, I guess, a lesser shonen work. You know, it is not on a Soul Eater level, but it's up there. It got an anime, you know. Bloodlad is about the demon world and a vampire named...
Is it Alucard, Dr. Acula, Vlad, the Imparter?
No, it's close, though. His name is Staz.
Staz
Charlie Blood, I think is his name. Staz Charlie Blood.
That you're making that up. His middle name is not Charlie.
It is. His middle name is Charlie. Staz Charlie Blood.
Just call him Chuck. Hey, Chucky.
Everybody calls him Staz. Staz is a kind of like local crime boss. He runs a protection racket for a certain number of territories in Demon Land, which when we're introduced to is essentially a slum. We find out later, like floating high up in the air is like where the rich demons live, and you can't get up there if you're one of the poors. So all the poors are kind of just ruled by crime bosses who have their own territories.
Okay.
Which they obviously run, you know, protection rackets over, and that's how they fund their extravagant anime lifestyles.
I mean, right off the bat, this is, this is kind of reminiscent of Dorohedoro and the stratified classes of the different hells there.
Yes, yes, and it definitely plays it a little madcap. You know, we have all kinds of demons, but they end up just being like weird dudes.
I mean, I love weird dudes. I don't have anything against weird dudes.
No, it's fine.
Yeah,
we have weird dudes of all kinds. You kind of assume it's going to be like monsters because the first guy we meet obviously is a vampire. He has a friend who's a werewolf, so you kind of think you're going along that trajectory.
I mean, logical next step would be a Frankenstein.
There is a Frankenstein. He's obviously a scientist. But then you just kind of meet other guys, and like one of them's just a three-eyed squirrel. I don't, maybe that's like a cryptid that I don't know about, but
don't remember that Universal monster movie.
Yeah. His second in command is just a big guy who's got like a big face tattoo. Never made clear like what that's about.
He's just there to look intimidating.
Yeah, there's a fish man.
Okay.
Yeah, we're kind of moving along these lines. One of the demons is one of the main character demons turns out to be a girl with dimensional space traveling powers. Okay, I don't know how that's a monster because she's just a girl.
She sounds way more powerful than all the rest.
Oh, she's extraordinarily powerful. In fact, like how powerful spatial magic turns out to be like a very central aspect of the entire plot. But the vampire is, in his own words, a human world otaku, which of course he is, right?
Oh.
He collects human world anime and manga, and he has a PlayStation, and he doesn't really care about anything except for, like, reading anime and watching... watching manga and
that's like in The Little Mermaid and saying Ariel's a human nerd, but then you look at her cave of like trinkets and it's all anime figures and DVD sets.
That is exactly what it is.
No, you're just a regular ass nerd.
It is a lot like a reverse Little Mermaid, because one day while he's sitting around playing PlayStation 1, His second in command calls him up and he's like, hey, a human girl just like wandered in here and we took her captive. Do you want to like check it out? And he's like, holy shit, a human world girl? Oh my God.
Okay, so we've got a Monsters, Inc. going on.
Yeah, so they kidnap her and they take her to him and he's like, holy shit, you're like a real actual like Japanese high school girl. This is the best day of my life.
Oh, because he's a pervert.
Yeah, and she's like, I would like to go home now, please. And he's like, okay, hold on a second. He goes off to do a quick territory defense. Some fucking weirdo steps up and like tries to kill him with his Bellossom. he just has a Bellossom for some reason and he attacks him with
it. What, like the Pokemon?
Yeah.
Okay.
It uses Vine Whip on him and he easily defeats it because he's a crazy vampire. But when he makes it back up to his room to enjoy his Japanese high school girl, he finds out that she's been eaten.
Oh, problem solved.
Yeah.
Does he try to un-eat her?
Well, it begins the quest of the manga, which is that he takes her ghost and he swears to the ghost that he will revive her back into the human world.
Wait, what ate her?
What's the pitcher plant one? That's not the Bellossom.
Oh, now I'm flailing on my Pokemon knowledge.
I know, right? Victory Bell.
Victory Bell.
Yes. It's a Victory Bell. Like, gets up into his room while he's fighting the Bellossom.
Okay, so there's just, like, killer plants all around this demon world.
Well, it's a killer plant user steps up to him to, like, challenge him for his gangster territory, right?
I see. Okay, I get
you. And he easily dispatches the Pokemon user, but the rogue Victory Bell did make it up into his room to eat the delicious human.
I mean, that's just nature. You can't prevent that. Yeah, in fact, no, it would be immoral to stop that Victory Bell from getting a hot meal.
He does kill it, but again, it is a plant, so nobody's super mad about that. And all of her bones come out, and he collects up all the bones, and he's like, "Ah, oh, shit. I wish I hadn't taken my eyes off her for even a second, because she immediately died."
It was just a goof. It was just a little whoopsie doodle.
He's just a little goof. But he does swear to her ghost that he'll do everything in his power to revive her back to the human world, thus initiating the main quest of the manga, which is this weirdo vampire dragging this timid Japanese high school girl ghost around a wacky demon world in an attempt to revive her to the human world. And we're kind of off to the races.
Yeah, okay. I can see it.
Yeah.
Personally, like, I don't know if he knew this or not, but you can just lie to ghosts. Like, that's allowed. It's explicitly in the rules. You can and should lie to ghosts.
The thing is, like, when he meets her, he is so into it, right?
Oh, right. I keep forgetting that he's a pervert.
In more ways than one, because when she dies, he realizes he's, like, not as into it, and he can't quite figure out why, but obviously we, as the audience, understand it's because ghosts don't have blood.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, he's a vampire, right? Wouldn't it have just turned into a whole thing? Kind of like with, what do you call it, Mayanaka Punch. I bet he would have discovered that she has the most tasty blood, right? Or Call of the Night. That's the hook with all these things. It's the human has the most tasty blood, and he just can't help himself because he's a vampire.
Well, in this case, it's because she's a human at all, which don't exist in the demon world. But when she's a ghost, she doesn't have blood.
She doesn't have blood. Yeah, no, it's
ghosts
don't have
blood. Like, I can't make this more clear. Ghosts, no blood.
Now, are you sure about that?
I am very sure.
Because I feel like I met a ghost once and they were bleeding, but it may have been ghost blood, which is probably a separate category from regular human blood that a vampire can drink.
You know, ghost scientists usually call that ectoplasm.
Yes, I knew there was an official term for it.
Yeah, that's what they would call that. Now, this is immediately complicated because, and this is a twist I did not see coming.
Uh-huh.
She drinks his blood.
Now I feel like it should go both ways. You can't drink a ghost's blood, and a ghost shouldn't be able to drink your blood.
Yeah, you'd think that, right?
Yeah, because she has no teeth.
Yeah, she's got no teeth. She's just a ghost. She can't, like, bite him. She gets really, it's a really weird thing where, like, he pricks his thumb and she, like, sucks on it. It's weird. but if this is, like, because she's a ghost and she's not really supposed to exist in the demon world, she, like, doesn't have enough demon energy to survive. So to maintain her, like, physical form, she needs his demon energy, which he delivers to her in the form of his own demon vampire blood.
There's a lot of confusing rules crisscrossing going on here. I'm not sure I'm a fan of this.
And this is a part that represents the whole, because this is a confusing crisscross that ends up representing the entirety of the plot of this manga, because she ends up becoming addicted to his blood, and you'd think this would become a bigger thing. So the thrust of the plot, if you were, like, you know, a person who expected some kind of coherent narrative from the manga you read, you would understand that the plot would be, he cannot decide whether he cares for this girl ghost or if he just wants to revive her so he can drink her delicious blood, right?
Right.
And she can't decide if she cares for this weird gangster vampire or if she is just hanging around him because he's going to revive her / she's now addicted to his blood. And that seems like a, you know, that's a conventional, compelling plot. As they continue on their adventure, they have like this emotional journey together and they kind of, you know, work through their emotions. Now, that is not what happens. That would be a smart manga. That would be something written by someone who wasn't like winging it.
And that's not what's going on here. I feel like maybe they are not a smart manga and maybe smart decisions were not made for these characters.
Unfortunately, no, that is not how it ends up playing out. This is a really interesting thing, though, because this whole time I was thinking about, you know, when we've mentioned it very shallowly before, but talking about the male gaze in manga and anime, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've often said, you know, there's a misrepresentation of that concept where people sometimes apply it as like very literally in that the male gaze is a way of looking at women in a physical way, like a literal physical way.
It's literally a first person point of view camera shot from a male character.
Yes. Or, you know, from the creator's point of view, which is represented by low camera angles when they're shooting women, or the classic pan up in the shower, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? We think of that as like the male gaze, which I don't think is necessarily wrong.
It's part of it, but it does not paint the entirety of the picture.
Yes, the concept of the male gaze, of course, is, you know, you are put into the perspective of traditional masculinity, and that's represented by like various facets of a narrative, not just perving on the girls in the story. And this is one that
Goku going Super Saiyan is part of the male gaze.
You could say that. I think that would be an interesting angle to look at. I find in Blood Lad, there's a really great example of it because the story is kind of the author understands that because the story is really about these two characters' relationships to each other, they know that they are supposed to write the girl with some kind of like internality or with her own agency in the narrative. But because this is very textbook definition male gazey, they cannot break out of everything revolving around the way the man, the central male protagonist, controls and views this story. So the story kind of culminates in a way where throughout the narrative, she is very passive. She is a timid, passive scaredy cat, very typical Japanese anime schoolgirl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he is mostly dragging her around this narrative, sometimes literally. There is a part of the story where he ties a rope around her waist and drags her around as if she's on a leash, which she does not comment on, really, besides saying, can you loosen the knot a little bit? That's her only, that's the only thought she has that the author exposes us to, right?
Yeah, no, a normal woman would be okay with this action. I see no reason for her to protest.
Yeah, which, you know, again, I think this is a useful illustration of like how the male gaze can be represented in a narrative. This is, the story is about how he feels about her essentially subjugation here, right? And The author, like I said, understands that there is supposed to be something with her, that she has to be part of the narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he constantly faints towards resolving her character conflicts, which culminates in, which I think is the perfect representation of this, our main character is constantly berating the female lead for not having agency in the story he is writing for her, which is very funny.
That's so meta.
Yeah, it's very weird.
Hey, why aren't you a more fully realized and self-sufficient female character in this story?
Exactly. And so this entire story culminates in, and this is some wild shit, because again, the author understands that you can't end this story without including the literal female lead who is introduced on page one. So the story culminates in the main characters all get beaten by the big bad character, right? Uh-huh. And the realization that they're going to have to collaborate with the human ghost girl in order to defeat him. That is very standard anime stuff, right?
Yeah.
The way they do that is the main character gets inside her body and pilots her body around. And without asking her, sucks in all the other characters into her body to pilot her body around.
Like some kind of meat Voltron?
Yes. That is literally what he says. He's obsessed with, because he's an otaku, right? He's obsessed with a giant robot.
Uh-huh.
So when he gets inside her, he manifests her ghost body as a giant, like, mechazord.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So this entire thing about how he is concerned that she is not asserting herself, taking agency in her own story, is almost immediately obliterated by the fact that he pilots her physical form around and she literally takes a backseat in her own body.
Oh my God. This is literally, why aren't you a better character? Fuck it, I'll just do it myself.
Yes. This is wild. And there's a lot of other stuff. I could get way into it because there's lots of smaller examples that I think illustrate the way that a narrative can also portray the male gaze through storytelling. But this is the most bombastic, insane way I have ever seen a manga illustrate this exact point. And the coup de grace here, the final blow, is less bombastic. This is actually a move that happens in like a lot of anime and gets kind of sublimated into sort of more of a genre move, which I still hate. You should hate it too, because it sucks. But it is revealed near the end, after they've beaten the bad guy, that they can finally resurrect her into the human world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And part of the resurrection process, our main character's brother, who is a genius scientist, tells the main character, okay, we're finally ready to, like, reconstruct her body and send her back to the human world. There is a catch, though. I'm pretty certain she's going to forget everything that happened.
Oh, okay.
And our main character is like, damn, that sucks. And the brother's like, so you're gonna tell her, right? And obviously our main character's like, nah, I'm gonna make the decision for her. And so they send her back and she forgets everything. And
listen, you cannot expect her to be a self-actualized complete female character. She's just a girl.
She's just a little girl. Well, here's the final capper. After choosing for her whether she wants to forget all of her memories or not, she goes back and she goes to school and she's like resuming her normal life. But, you know, she has the thing where, like, oh, I kind of have these like lingering feelings and I don't know where they came from. Very weird. Must be a very weird and uncomfortable feeling to have that, right?
Yeah. Torturous.
Yes. This is also something that comes up in Noragami too, which weirdly enough is almost very, very similar plot. I like Noragami. Does this a little bit better. But after he's made this whole decision for her that fundamentally alters her life in a lot of different ways, he decides to transfer into her class and just force himself on her.
What?
Just as kind of a final fuck you.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I
have a lot of thoughts about Blood Lad, but most of them are very unimportant and nitpicky stuff that's just like, here's stupid shonen shit. I think this is really the headline here, is that, holy shit, what the fuck?
I have no words. That's like if at the end of GTO, he's like, all right, so long, kids. I'm no longer going to be your teacher. Right off into the sunset. And then at the end, the next school day starts and he's like, hey, I'm a 27 year old enrolling into school. Hey, everybody.
Hey, guys. Also, I'm a student here now.
Yeah, I'm a student here now.
I'm a student now. It's, Every step of the way, I was shocked, just shocked. And also, like I said at the top about how these, like, you know, it's constantly fainting at, like, this overarching plot, but none of this stuff makes any sense because it's constantly being woven in and out of the narrative, because it's all being, you know, this is a very much a winging it style narrative.
Yeah, this sounds like stream of consciousness writing.
Yes.
Like, all right, and then they got to do the beach episode, and then, I don't know, maybe they have a big laser fight, and then a bikini contest. I assume there is a bikini contest.
Well, I mean, every female character, which are, you know, there are only a couple, all are...
Well, I can't have too many characters that you need to make decisions for.
Yeah, we have our main helpless ghost girl. We have the girl who is the spatial magician girl, who is, for strange reasons we kind of don't understand, madly in love with the protagonist, but can't admit it to herself and him until the end, when she's like, hey, I like you. Can you please just, like, tell me that you don't like me so I can stop obsessing over this? And he's like, huh. And then that's the end of that. We just resolve that storyline. Cool. And then, of course, their mother, it turns out they're related. They have one mom.
Oh.
She's also a fat titty anime lady who's ultra sexy and at one point kind of sexually teases our main character vampire. Who kind of doesn't really have a sexuality of his own. It's very weird. There's a lot of points where you would normally have, like, the kind of pervy protagonist character be like, oh, I'm gonna eat, like, peek on the girls, or like, oh, like, her body is making me uncomfortable. And that doesn't really happen here. He's kind of completely ambivalent to sexuality in every way, which is very strange.
Well, that's because he treats his interest in humans the way, you know, he treats humans the way, like, an internet moderator, an unpaid internet moderator treats Funko Pops, right? They are collectible figurines that he likes to ogle, but he's not attracted to Funko Pops, you know?
This is sexuality of all kinds. Like, and there are parts, you know, there's a gag, obviously, where he's constantly carrying her through the air because he's super powerful and she's just a person. So he's constantly, like, inappropriately touching her, right? But it is never like, I mean, obviously she reacts like, oh my God, this is, what the fuck are you doing? But he never has any kind of, like, sexual interest in that at all, which is just, considering all this other stuff, is just a really weird choice, especially because by the end of it, the author has decided that this is a love story in some weird way.
And then they kissed. I don't know.
That is just another very weird choice. And also all that interesting stuff I said at the beginning where, like, the character can't decide if he wants to suck her blood or, like, be in a relationship with her. And where she can't decide if she's addicted to his blood or if she's, like, in love with him because he's her knight in shining armor, right?
Right.
None of that matters.
None of it matters.
None of it matters. None of it comes up. They just reach the end of the story, and the main character is like, hey, you should be alive because I love you. And she's like, your love gives me the power to be alive again. And that's why I'm alive. And it's just how it just flops like a dead fish until the final chapter. This is a fucking weird manga, man.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, you have completely killed any remnants of Christmas spirit I had lingering around my heart. Why don't we take a break?
Yeah, all right. All right, Nate, you know, I did read a weird Wolverine comic by Nihei Tsutomu that I feel a little ashamed of not knowing about, considering I've constantly said I'm such a huge Nihei Tsutomu fan. I'm also really ashamed that It took me this long to watch the Mononoke movie. It's been out for like, I don't know, a month now. And we didn't even mention it. I felt bad about bringing it up because I hadn't watched it, but I finally did watch that. But let's not talk about that stuff.
No, let's talk about something fun, like crime.
Yeah, let's revisit our anime crimes. It's been a while, and last time we talked about a really fun topic, incest.
Yeah,
one of the top anime crimes. Really, I mean,
one of my favorites. Really.
Yeah, you really like it. You've been reading a lot of these incest rom-coms.
Oh, yeah.
My sister's a Gyaru.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, the classic is Onimai, Now I'm Your Sister.
Oh,
a lot
Jesus
of weird stuff
Christ.
Going on there.
Yeah, don't even get me started on the weird gender-bending ones, because, man, there's a lot of psychology going on.
Listen, we're digressing. There's plenty of other crimes out there that we have yet to discuss. I think it's time that we bring a little bit of light to these charges because, you know, I think you and I can agree that right now the taste for justice is on the lips of the American people. You know, they want swift retribution.
Yes, and what could possibly deliver it more swiftly and more justly than an anime podcast?
It's what the Founding Fathers envisioned.
Exactly. And, you know, the main problem of the incest crime, which is very serious in anime crime, but it's not just an anime crime. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's a real crime that real
people
go to, jail for.
A real actual crime. So this time I wanted to focus more on like a very anime specific crime.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. I agree.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, what else could I be talking about? But the silver-haired star child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Everybody knows what I mean.
Well, okay, so maybe we should... I know what you mean. The American people know what you mean.
Everybody
maybe
knows.
Maybe some of those weirdos over in Europe, who I hear are a bit fruity, know what you mean. But
what do you mean
why
by
you,
that? What, hold on, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? Hold on, what do you mean by that?
Listen,
Okay, let's talk about the anime. So, what do we mean by the silver-haired star child? This is a trope that shows up in anime all the time, hence the crime. We'll get to, let's say, a halfway or maybe even two-thirds of the way through an anime, and the plot will kind of be stalling out. There won't be really anywhere to go. So, in order to inject some blood, some movement, some energy back into a narrative, an anime will introduce a new mysterious character, and this is the silver-haired star child.
Yes.
Some kind of almost Deus Ex Machina sort of character who knows something about the world, knows the world in a deeper level than any of our other characters, and for whatever reason doesn't want to elaborate on that. They would rather sort of guide everybody from the shadows by reciting cryptic poetry or demonstrating incredible miraculous powers, but only in baffling ways that never actually help anyone.
Yeah, kind of like Gandalf coming back as Gandalf the White after being Gandalf the Gray.
Sure, that's great. And he is sort of a star child, I guess.
Yeah, literally fell to earth from heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's an angel.
Now, the problem being, and this is what I want to discuss, is when we were talking about this earlier, I realized Nate sort of has his own interpretation of this particular trope. You know, Nate and I aren't a hive mind. We agree and disagree on various things. And mm-hmm, I found it mm-hmm. interesting that he pulled some examples of this that weren't immediately apparent to me. So I'm really interested in explaining to me what he considers the essence of the silver-haired star child.
I think that once I explain some of my picks here, we're going to be more in agreement than you're leading on. I just think that your definition is maybe a little overly specific. Okay. Maybe not as universally applicable as the way I'm using it.
Sure. Well, why don't we start on even ground just as our beginning point?
Sure.
Because I think when people think of the Silver-Haired Star Child, and this may be a little bit of recency bias because Evangelion landing on Netflix and everybody talking about it again, mm-hmm. but Keoru from Eva is such a quintessential Silver-Haired Star Child. He comes out of nowhere. He says a bunch of cryptic shit.
He has silver hair.
Nobody really knows what his deal is. He recites poetry that doesn't mean anything. He does some weird behind-the-scenes shit. He pulls some strings in the shadows and has some kind of effect on the plot that we're never particularly clear on, but seems important nevertheless. This is a very quintessential.
This is the bog-standard textbook Silver-Haired Star Child, absolutely.
And kind of sets the bar for Silver-Haired Star Children in general.
Yeah.
But was not the first and definitely not the last.
Oh, nowhere near. So I don't know. Let me follow up with my first pick here.
Sure.
And we can, you know, put it against that measure. I chose, and I don't know how familiar you were with this, but you remember Zoids? You remember Zoids, Remy?
I mean, yeah, I kind of remember Zoids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So Zoids was the large animal-themed robot fighting competition anime. I believe the very first Zoids series, you know, the premise was that they were essentially cross-country racing robots.
Is that true?
Kind of like
what?
They would race across the country in a wacky races / speed racer esque fashion, where they would battle each other in you know, competitive long format races. And sometimes they would have like arena matches, but definitely racing was part of it.
So it was more like that, like cross country skiing, but with rifles kind of thing, whatever they call that.
Yeah. Yeah. The biathlon is what that's called.
Whatever you say.
And so obviously the first follow up that anyone, a rational person, has to a setting like that is, why aren't they using the giant death robots to fight each other in like wars and shit and actually kill each other? And that's where Zoid's Chaotic Century comes in, which is a prequel series set, I believe, like 100 years before the robot combat era of Zoids.
Sure.
Where Zoids were, in fact, being used to fight a brutal civil war and like children were dying every day.
Yeah, a very anime. Maybe we should put that as a trope someday of the anime that just unloads a horrific backstory of like, yes, child murder on what is otherwise a pretty lighthearted, like fun child romp. That seems to happen a lot.
That's another episode.
Yeah, that's another episode.
And so the central premise of this one, I'll speed this up a bit, but again, another anime crime trope that we'll get to later, but girl in the box, right? You need a girl in the box to pilot your giant spaceship or your giant robot or something.
Absolutely.
Except in this time, it's not a girl. It is a tiny robot dinosaur that acts kind of like a, you know, faithful pet. And so our main character has a robot dinosaur that is special. He's the only one that has one. And it's the size of a large dog or maybe small mini horse. And when he gets in his Zoid...
You mean a pony?
No, a mini horse. Ponies are different.
A mini, okay.
But like a small mini horse.
Right.
And so the robot dinosaur crawls in a special seat inside of his larger robot and gives his robot super robot powers. You know, standard stuff, right?
This is like when you install an external GPU on your computer.
Yeah, kind of.
To give it a boost.
And so, like you said, about halfway through the series, now we have to start kicking things up. You know, we've established that our main guy can use his robot dinosaur pal and really kick ass in his giant tiger robot. I don't know why his giant robot wasn't also a dinosaur to match up with the small one, but that's beside the point. And so we introduce a villain counterpart to our main character, who is a silver-haired star child who comes in halfway through the series espousing cryptic messages about how he is the superior being, and he has a evil-themed little robot dinosaur, a black and red one, that gets inside of his velociraptor-shaped robot. And so now they are matching up, which is evil, I guess.
Wait, how is his robot evil? How do they represent the evilness of the robot?
Well, you see, the good robot dinosaur is blue and silver and, wags its tail a lot. And the evil one is black and red and it has horns.
Oh, okay. All right. So he's a devil bot.
Yeah, he's a devil dinosaur bot. And,
I gotcha.
And they make up kind of a celestial robot dinosaur yin yang that when combined together gives a robot pilot, a Zoid pilot, godlike robot piloting powers. But obviously one's evil, one's good. There's a lot of mythological, astrological, navel-gazy dialogue revolving around whether or not it's right or true to use Zoids as murder machines.
Sure.
Also, the Zoids are kind of like semi-organic. Like, they are robots, but they're robots that get born.
Ew.
Like, by other robots. it gets messy. But this kid comes in halfway through, silver hair, cosmological knowledge of Zoidbots.
Right.
I think that counts.
Okay, and what is the war about states' rights?
The war is about whether or not the either side is good enough to kill all of the other ones with giant robots.
Okay, so it's a war, but it's not a political war. It's just one of those wars that happens.
It's one of those apolitical wars.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
I think that counts, right?
Well, my question would be, like, does he have hidden knowledge?
Yes. He's okay. The one that introduces the audience to the knowledge that Zoids are not created by humans. They
gotcha.
They pop up.
They're aliens.
They're not aliens.
Oh,
they're
no?
Like made by this by the Transformers Cybertron robot heart of the planet. Again, it gets messy near the
okay.
end, but that's the gist of it.
That's pretty wild. Does he like talk in like cryptic poetry?
You know, he says, he says like stuff like, he does the you humans thing quite a bit, you know.
I was going to mention at the top, one of the very closely related crimes with the silver-haired star child is, and these often overlap, is the you humans crime, where a guy who's just a guy, but maybe he can fly or shoot lasers out of his eyes, just decides that that's enough to differentiate him from humanity. So he just starts calling people Ningen.
Yeah,
you human.
Like think Vegeta, early appearance Vegeta.
Yeah, he's like exactly a dude. Five fingers, five toes. He's almost got a unibrow. It's like, you are a dude. You're a dude.
Hey, you're just a guy.
You're a guy. What are you fucking talking about? In fact, you've got a tail and he doesn't, and that's the only difference. But silver-haired star children often play into this either on one side or the other, where they will pretend to be a guy or they will pretend to not be a guy. They usually split the difference.
But yeah, this kid comes in and he starts saying stuff like, yeah, humans are on their way out. A dawning of the new age of Zoidquarius is on its way. You know, basic shit.
Okay. I think that is a compelling case. I wanted to talk about some of the OGs. I think these really set the tone of the modern silver-haired star child that kind of led to Kaworu, you know?
Sure.
My favorite being Ryo from Devilman. Now, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Devilman.
Well, I can only assume that he is some kind of Angel Man counterpart.
Yeah, in a higher level way, is sort of an eagle eye way of the Devilman story. He kind of is that. I don't know. Did you ever get around to watching Devilman Crybaby? Because that's a very good version of Devilman.
I haven't yet. It's on my list, you know, Yuasa.
It's really, really good, dude. Oh, my God. But it is essentially a retelling of the original Devilman story, which is our main character, Akira, discovers that he's essentially compatible with demon DNA.
He's some kind of devil man.
Yes, Debuduman. And his best friend, Ryo, is sort of a mysterious... He's not a delinquent, but he is sort of portrayed as a genius delinquent. He'll come to school, but he'll just like do whatever he wants. And sometimes he'll just skip. He'll do crazy shit. He doesn't give a fuck what anybody else says about him. He stunts on everybody. He drives a coupe to school. He's like wearing fashionable clothes. His teachers are like, hey, you got to wear a uniform to school. And he's like, fuck you, teacher. And then he like lights up in class. He's wearing shades all the time. He's just like a cool guy who also happens to be like a mysterious genius.
He's just like a really chill and cool guy who's down to earth.
Well, he's not chill at all. He has no chill. He is not chill.
Oh, he's anti-chill.
I don't want to misrepresent him. He is incredibly not chill. In fact,
this guy's not chill at all.
By the time our story begins, he is like in the middle of the least chill period of his life he has ever been in. He kind of kidnaps Akira from school one day at the beginning of the series and tells him...
Kidnapping's not a chill thing to do.
Well, it's like, hey, Akira, you're not going to school today. You're coming with me. And Akira's like, well, but I have club today. Rhea's like, I don't give a fuck, dude. What the fuck are you talking about? Get in the coupe. Put these sunglasses on. We're going over to my place.
Get in, loser.
Yeah, he gets literally get in, loser. He rolls up. He's like, get in, loser. Akira looks over at his girlfriend and she's like, what the fuck? You're just going to leave me here? And Akira's like, that's my bro. I'm going with him. And so he hops on the coupe and Ryo basically turns to him and says, look, I didn't want to tell you this before, but I am a silver-haired star child. I have secret knowledge of the universe. I'm going to talk to you essentially in riddles for the rest of the series. But first, I'm going to inject you with some dino DNA. And you're going to turn into Debuduman because I need you to save the human race, who I don't seem to be particularly interested in. So my motives are actually very mysterious. He never comes out and says it.
Get in, loser. We're going devil fighting.
Yeah, and he never comes out and says it, but it is heavily implied that maybe he's not human to begin with either, because by the time the story starts, his quote-unquote scientist father is already dead, maybe by Ryo's hand. Maybe. We don't know. Maybe. Who knows?
He's a pretty sketchy guy, it seems like.
Yeah, and as the story takes on more and more epic proportions, Ryo begins guiding everything towards his own cryptic and mysterious ends.
Okay, all right.
And also, he's like a hot twink with silver hair who's cool, like, all the time.
Well, you see, that I think is more important to the aspect of the trope than anything else.
That's one of your bigger signs for it, is the hot twink with silver hair who's cool.
You gotta be a hot twink with silver hair who's cool.
You have to be cool, and you have to play everything cool.
You are the cool one. You wouldn't have silver hair otherwise.
Exactly.
Like, that's cool.
That's cool.
Do you know how cool that is?
Much like when you give the girl, the kind of crazy girl, the pink hair.
Yeah.
When you see a girl with pink hair in an anime, you're kind of like, oh no, she might be...
Or you give the tsundere red hair or something like that, right?
Yeah. Or the like strong-headed character, the shrine maiden cut, sort of super harsh bangs, and then like...
We all know what a shrine maiden looks like, Remy.
Yeah,
come
mid-level
on.
Hair. So the silver hair is a big tell, obviously. It's in the title of the crime.
Yeah, I think it's maybe even the most important feature compared to all other aspects.
I generally remove all characters from this list that aren't silver-haired. I think that's a pretty big part of it. Yeah.
Generally, and we will get to that.
Generally, yeah.
Which is why I think that one of the classics, if we're talking about the canon, Sephiroth, absolutely, is a poster boy for this.
Yes, now you went straight to this one, and I was a little embarrassed that he didn't come to me at first, because he absolutely... Now, he's one of the rare ones that's a villain.
Not only is he a rare one that's a villain, well, like Raven from Zoid's Chaotic Century.
Yes, yes.
But He's also not explicitly a twink. He's got some upper body, like, workout routine, you know?
Okay,
he's got
sure.
pecs. He's got biceps.
He's tall. He's ripped. Mm-hmm.
He's sexy. He's sexy
he's
as
sexy.
Fuck.
He's sexy. He plays everything cool.
He comes in a little bit earlier than most. He comes in about a third way into the narrative of Final Fantasy VII. Definitely espousing cryptic shit, talking about, oh, humans again are on their way
you
out.
Humans.
You
humans.
Humans. The age of humans is ending. I am the true super being.
I have secret knowledge of the universe.
I have secret knowledge of the ancient universe, and yeah. I'm going to resurrect my alien mother so we can ride the planet into a black hole and become gods. Standard stuff.
Or just party.
Yeah, or just party. No one ever talks about how good of a party Sephiroth threw.
We get a couple of like cuts back to the ancient ones,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed like the main thrust was that they were just like having a good time partying.
They were just partying. They were getting drunk. They didn't have any worries. No priors at the time, right? No parole officers.
Yeah, and then everything went real bad.
And then Sephiroth comes in with his alien mama and just fucks everything up for everybody.
Yeah.
And he starts writing down weird poetry and mind-controlling Cloud and you know, all around real not cool, not chill guy stuff. And so, yeah, I think Sephiroth is a pretty shoo-in case for this, even though he is not technically a child at the time that he's doing all of the Star Child stuff.
You know, that's true, but at the same time, he is like a clone.
Yeah, no, that's he's like a half clone. He's half clone,
half
alien.
He's like a half clone. Yeah, so I think maybe he's not as old as he appears.
Yeah. Now, this next one on the list is something that you threw out, and I actually think that it probably applies a little less to this title than some other things on here. Why did you put Vicious from Cowboy Bebop on this list?
I think the big problem with Vicious, and I'm willing to lose Vicious. I think Vicious is one of the weaker entries in this list, mainly because Vicious is just not in Cowboy Bebop. He's just not in it.
He's like the Boba Fett of Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah.
People think he's a lot cooler than he actually is.
Yeah, he's basically not in Cowboy Bebop, and really most of his mystery just comes from people kind of like whispering his name.
Yeah.
In like dark corners of bars.
Also, his name is Vicious, and that's pretty cringy.
Yeah, it's pretty cringy. Spike goes like, man, that Vicious. I don't really want to talk about it.
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, and everybody's like, well, that's crazy. Like, what is with this dude that Spike doesn't even want to talk about it? All lends he builds up a mystery. And then with Vicious being the only guy that kind of controls Spike's destiny, even though he doesn't even appear, also really layers on the mystery and sort of the puppeteering from the shadows element.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he does have white hair.
He does have white hair. He is pretty twinky. I'll give him that.
He has secret knowledge, not of the universe, but of Spike.
But of the mafia and of Spike. Yeah.
He knows stuff about Spike that we never learn.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. They have a mysterious fraternal background together that we never get a full picture on. Just snippets here and there.
I think Vicious probably kind of read the room one day and like tried to kiss Spike, and Spike got really freaked out by his feelings and like took off to be a bounty hunter. I've always assumed that was the backstory.
What a loser. Why not stay around with your hot bisexual mafia boyfriend?
Well, he never dates anyone. He is like the eligible bachelor, right? Is like everybody goes, why that dude's like hot and cool. Why has he never dated anyone? And we know the answer.
Oh my God, they were roommates.
Liberace was gay. But the women loved him.
Oh man. I'm just now learning this.
So I think, I don't know, Vicious is around the trope. He's not the strongest entry.
He's not the strongest. I think a stronger entry would be, say, someone, and this is getting a little more unconventional, and I will defend this choice. I put Riku from Kingdom Hearts on here. Now he is, in fact, somewhat villainous. He plays a villain role many times throughout the series.
He's a jerk.
He's definitely a jerk. You know, everything else aside about Kingdom Hearts and its many, many, many faults. Riku is like an asshole and a bad friend, and I don't know why Sora goes out of his way so much to like try and help him, because man, he really sucks a lot of the time.
He's a really bad friend. Like, he mostly just kind of like is super condescending to Sora, like even before all the stuff happens,
even before he gets super darkness powers, he's doing the "you humans suck, I'm so much above you" shtick.
And also he's like, hey Sora, I'm like, I can like jump higher than you and like do cool moves, and you can't really do that. But I'm gonna try to challenge you to do it, and then like laugh at you like failing. That's kind of like his main pastime.
Listen, we all have that friend who likes to pretend that he's, you know, smarter and hotter and better than all the rest of you and rub it in your faces.
We do.
All through high school. Yeah, we all have that friend.
We do.
And then we start an anime podcast with him in our 30s.
Weird.
We all have that friend.
We have that. What's weird? Let me think about that. Hold on. My problem with Riku is that he's not like mysterious in the way that I kind of usually assign to the silver-haired star child. He is a character that is introduced within like the first 5 seconds of the game. We kind of follow his journey from beginning to end. He does pretend to have hidden knowledge, but as we find out, he is just on the ride with everybody else.
Well, okay, but here is where I think that he does qualify. If you will remember, if you were a hardcore gamer back in 2001, got the secret ending of Kingdom Hearts, and you got the hidden secret cutscene that was a preview for the story of Kingdom Hearts 2, where we see Riku fighting a Heartless, and he's wearing a cool black trench coat like in the Matrix, and he's got a cool black blindfold on like Gojo from Jujutsu Kaisen, and
like Neo from the Matrix,
or like Neo from the third Matrix movie. And get this, because it's gonna blow your fucking mind, he was fighting Heartless with two Keyblades, spouting cryptic shit about the coming storm, and how I don't know, destiny shit is coming, and all hell is coming with it.
Sure.
And
punish
he
Riku.
He re-mysteriousizes himself to the narrative in that way.
Yeah, but for all we know, he could have just gotten a new jacket.
Like, hey, did anyone ever ask, like, who was selling all those jackets in Kingdom Hearts? Where did they all get the same jacket?
Did they get the jackets from an alternate dimension where those jackets are really common?
They went to the dimension planet where it's all jackets instead of Disney movies.
Yeah. I think that's one of the Final Fantasy dimensions.
I don't know. I think Riku absolutely was mysterious and cool and silver-haired enough. And, you know, contrary to several other people on this list, was an actual child. Just saying.
Yes, he was a child.
I stand by that.
Sure. In that regard, well, let me give you a couple, because it would behoove us to not mention, next to Ryo, one of the OGs, which is, of course, Griffith from Berserk.
Well,
he is absolutely a silver-haired star child of destiny,
but also a character that gets introduced relatively early in the narrative, and we see a complete arc from start to finish with him. Well, maybe not finish.
Well, not start and not finish, because when we are introduced to him, he is already mysterious, and
no, I don't.
Everyone around him is drawn in by his mysterious aura. He is a child of destiny from the second he supposedly arrived on Earth. We have no idea, because, again, we, like, who the fuck knows?
He's not mysterious. He's just hot. There's a difference.
He is absolutely mysterious. He is super cool.
Well, no arguments there.
He's got a badass attitude. Like, no one like is really on his level. He's always got that like hidden smirk. Like, he knows he's like backstage of the universe. He's got secret knowledge. He's puppeting. everything, everywhere. He is like literally like playing kings and eventually gods against each other to like get what he wants. This dude,
he is your favorite silver-haired star child's favorite silver-haired star child.
I mean, he is the dude.
He's the guy. He's the dude. El Duderino. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Griffith is a silver-haired star child, even though he's not a child for most
of
it. He is
a child when we meet him. We meet him, and it is not made super clear, but we know that Guts and Griffith are around the same age. And Guts is like 14 when he meets him, so...
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
He's just so tall, I forget about it.
It's very... They're both children, essentially. Just barely,
you know,
teens.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention that Griffith was doing Sephiroth shit before Sephiroth was doing it.
Oh, of course. There is no Sephiroth without Griffith.
Yeah.
I do want to say there is an actual child. I will bring up an actual child here. From Mirai Nikki, Future Diary, which came after Eva, and the character Aru Akise is one of the diary characters, who is essentially a Kaworu. He is almost a carbon copy of Kaworu in this story. The story of Future Diary is, of course, a bunch of characters get into a death game. They all carry diaries, which in this case is actually just cell phones.
Oh, okay.
The diaries are cell phones. I don't know why it's called Future Diary. Because they're cell phones.
Does anyone really journal on their cell phone? I think that's called blogging, right?
Not if you don't publish it.
Well, fair enough. It would be a different series if it was called Future Blogger.
Yeah. We have, I mean, besides the death game part, Future Diary follows Eva in sort of interesting ways. It mirrors them in interesting ways where our main character Yuki kind of ends up being a reluctant teen hero in the same way Shinji does in a lot of aspects. And Aru Akise appears around the same time in the story as Kaworu does. He is mysterious. He has the silver hair. He is a child. And he has secret knowledge of the universe game. Did I mention that Future Diary is about a death game where the prize is you get to replace God as God? Did I mention that part?
Not in this episode, but we have talked about it. So, yeah. Longtime fans would know this information intimately already.
Well, I probably have said that is the end game of a lot of death games, is to just replace God. I don't know why that's so
common.
It's
about the only thing that you could entice me with to participate in a death game instead of just offing myself, like, right at the beginning.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of why I say Battle Royale is a real pale death game, because, like, the prize is...
You get to live in this horrible dictatorship.
Yeah, you get to go back to high school. Like, that's the prize. Like, that fucking sucks, dude. Every other death game, it's like you get infinite power. But Aru is a character, like I said, appears basically two-thirds of the way through the story and reveals themselves to be, like, this mysterious presence and decides, much like Kaworu, not to participate in the story as, like, an active... I don't know, agent.
A participant.
But instead devote themselves to helping Yuki win the game. And by doing that, he assumes this like cryptic role where he's constantly spouting poetry and like helping him from the shadows. Aru is a very standard silver-haired star child, especially in the aspect that we essentially never really know what his deal is, even after the story ends. To the point where they made like a separate parallel world story just to kind of explain what his whole shit was.
Okay, I think that's enough for today, handsome and beautiful listeners. Thank you again for what I assume listening to our ramblings about weird anime tropes.
It's educational.
Yeah, educational.
You're learning things. You know, like how the secret Santa Claus we didn't mention is, of course, the one from Chainsaw Man.
Yes.
Now you know.
Satan Claus, as they call it.
Sure. A weird German woman, the epitome of evil.
Oh, right. That's Santa Claus.
Remember? I'm not joking. That's Santa Claus.
Okay. All right. That's it. go check out the blue sky. Give us likes. Do all the stuff. All right.
Bye. actually really cool that old man's confused.